Here's another Berlin bonus feature from NPR FM Berlin 104.1. This past March, Dr. Christopher Wythe spoke at the American Goethe Society in Washington, D.C. about one of the first abstract modern painters, Vasily Kandinsky. Christopher Wythe is a senior lecturer at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C.
Let me introduce Kandinsky to you. He is a man who was born in Russia, who in the 20s became German, and in the 30s became French. So it's sort of a long thing if you say, you know, German, American, French, Russian, all in there. He was born in 1866 and died in 1944. So he was almost 78 years of age at his death. He almost made it to, he was 70, so almost made it to 78. His father was a tea merchant, well established, made a lot of money. Indeed, one often asks, well, how did these people make their money? Well, for the first, let's say, years from the time he went to Munich, which I'll get to in a minute, until about 1917, 1918, when the property was expropriated by the communists, Kandinsky's father had bought an apartment building, and Kandinsky lived off of the revenue from that building. After that, or even before that, he'd become such a well-established artist and had exhibitions, et cetera, that he didn't really need to worry about an income. But as I said, he was born in 1866. His father was a tea merchant. And as a child, this is important, as a child, he drew, he wrote poems, played the piano and the cello. So even as a child, he had artistic abilities. Now, I say that's important because he didn't set out to be an artist. He set out to be a lawyer. He went to the University of Moscow, and he studied economics, law, and ethnography. And indeed, he actually was on the law faculty of Moscow University. After he finished his studies, they hired him. This is now moving ahead to 1893, he was hired as a professor at the University of Moscow. So his career was moving in a completely different direction on the surface. All of a sudden, in 1896, he drops his law, he drops his professional career, and he moves to Munich and becomes an artist at the age of 30. Now, as I said, he already had these artistic sort of interests bubbling all the time throughout his life. Now, another thing I need to mention before we move on to Munich, etc., is to mention to you that in 1889, he was part of an ethnographic team that went to Western Siberia to investigate a sort of isolated Finno-Ugric tribe of Russians who were living in this remote area. And the reason I mention it to you is because I want to read you a quote from Kandinsky that you'll see the relevance a little bit later. "I shall never forget the great wooden houses covered with carvings. They taught me," this is the important sentence, "they taught me to move within the picture, to live in the picture. I still remember how I entered the living room for the first time and stood rooted to the spot before this unexpected scene. Every object was covered with brightly colored, elaborate ornaments, folk pictures on the walls, symbolic representation of heroes, battles, etc., etc." So that this feeling of moving within a picture, of being enveloped by art, this experience, even though it was in 1893, long, at least several years before, or sorry, 1889, several years before he went to Munich, still stayed with him the whole time. And it certainly will be important when we talk about his paintings, but certainly is also important for his experiences of the aesthetic, the otherworldly, the spiritual, of walking into this house with its ornaments and its paintings all throughout, which he, as he wrote even later in his life, was very, very important to him. Now, in 1896, he gave up everything and moved to Munich. Well, one would say, well, why didn't he go to Berlin? Why didn't he go to Dusseldorf? Cologne. Well, Berlin at the time was the happening place. Most of the artists, many of whom are academic artists, and we no longer know much about them, or only the specialists do, but Munich was the hot spot to be. it was filled with all kinds of scholars and writers and painters and intellectuals who were living there, and it was the first German city to have a secession movement. By that I mean, like the French Impressionists who broke away from the Academy, the Germans did it in Munich first in 1892. So there was already this controversy of what art should be going on before Kandinsky got there, or just before he got there in 1896. Now, when he gets there, he studies with two artists who are not well known anymore. One, a Slovenian artist, Anton Esby, and the other, a very well-known, if somewhat obscure, German artist, Franz von Stuck. When he gets to Munich, and I'm going to quote here, he said, "I welcome the label art mill and felt I was in the city of art, which for me was the same as being in fairyland." So for him, it was a paradise. It was the place for him to be. So Kandinsky felt this was the place. If he was going to learn art, this was where he was going to do it. Now, after he studies, he starts at about 1900 to set up himself as his own career. And he very quickly meets this woman, Gabriella Munter, who becomes his companion. Now, there is a slight problem. He was already married to his second cousin, who he had married in Moscow before he even left to go to Munich. Needless to say, they eventually divorced. And Gabriella Munter felt very jilted because when the First World War started, Kandinsky was an enemy alien. He had to leave the country. Their relationship ended. She was very, very upset because he refused to continue it with her. And indeed, when he left, he went back to Russia and married again, a second time. His marriage to the first wife had dissolved. He married a second time in Russia. And Gabriel Munter basically didn't speak to him after that, except to return some of the furniture and stuff to him that they had bought together. But after all, hey, he's an artist, right? In the early part of the 20th century, Kandinsky travels a lot, and he spends almost a year in Munich, in Paris, in 1905 to 1906, exactly the time that Matisse is coming out with Fauvism. This is the point I'll come back to. As I said, when the war breaks out, he leaves and goes back to Russia. He is in Russia 1914 to late 1921. He then leaves, and we'll come back to this. He leaves and goes to Germany again and works at the Bauhaus. And he stays at the Bauhaus from Weimar to Dessau to Berlin. So he's at the Bauhaus the whole time of its existence. Now, I'm sure most of you know that the Bauhaus was a school of art, architecture, and applied decoration. It stems from medieval ideas of guilds. It goes through William Morris in England and the idea of creating fine crafts in a guild-like setting to becoming, in Germany, all of that plus having modern materials used to make designs, to make new ideas, to make new art. And Kandinsky works throughout this whole time as a teacher of one of the fundamental courses at the Bauhaus. Of the students first had to learn about materials and designs and colors, then they begin to specialize in, say, interior design, metalworking, whatever. And of course, he was working with some of the great architects and great writers and thinkers and artists of the time, from Gropius to Oscar Schlemmer to Paul Klee, who I mentioned before, and to others. It was a real hotbed of innovation. Needless to say, when the Nazis took over in 1933, it was closed. It had moved to Berlin because it kept getting kicked out of the various areas it was in for financial reasons, political reasons, whatever. And when it dissolved in 1933, Kandinsky left and went to Paris. And it was in Paris that he dies in 1944. He lives in a suburb of Paris and is in Paris throughout the Second World War. And because, in large part, he had become a French citizen, the thought is that, yes, he had a bleak and meager life, but he was left alone by the Nazis and the Gestapo. They never touched him in all those years. So here you see sort of admittedly, my PowerPoint isn't as great as it could be, a little bit grainy image of a later Kandinsky towards the end of his life. Now, there are a couple of moments that are important that get Kandinsky's thought processes moving towards abstraction and non-objectivity. And some of them happen in the years before he even goes to Munich. And I'm showing you here sort of two examples of that. One of them was a painting like this one of the haystacks, or in this case, the wheat stacks, that Monet painted. There is, and I should mention that Kandinsky wrote a lot. He wrote theoretical tracts. He wrote something called the Reminiscences, sort of about his life. So there's a great deal of documentation on him by him. And in the case of the Monet, he very clearly says he went to an exhibition to see Monet's work. And when he walked in, he was taken by the fact that he couldn't make sense of what he was seeing. It was just a blur of color and shapes, but he felt drawn to it. It felt it had a compelling attraction to him, and he wanted to find out what it was. And when he got up closer, he realized it was these haystacks. But it was this idea that color and line and shape in and of themselves can attract you that got him to begin to think that art can be more than just a narrative representation of the real world, no matter how abstracted and differentiated it might be, as Monet has done it there. The other basic influence before he even got to Munich is he experienced an opera, Lohengrin, by Richard Wagner. And he began to realize the idea of the Gesamtkunstwerk. The idea that there is a totality to art. So now connect that quote that I read you about those houses he saw in Siberia with being inside a painting to hearing Wagner's Gesamtkunstwerk, to the Bauhaus, and to, as we'll see later, other events in his life that he began to think that there is a large concept out there of what art can be and that people are moving towards it even before he moves into the field to further the ideas of what art could be. And the last thing is in Germany now, in Munich, he hears a concert by Arnold Schoenberg. And he's so taken by it that he not only gets to meet Schoenberg, but he does this painting based on the music of Schoenberg that he had heard, this work called Impression 3, Concert of 1911, is sort of his reaction to it. Now, this composition already begins to give you an idea where Kandinsky is going with his art. Now, I'll save the explanation for later, but what I can mention to you here is that besides being a very intelligent, well-read, well-connected individual, he was also a man who had what's called synesthetic sense, which means he hears music and he sees colors. And this is what happened to him very clearly here with the music of Schoenberg. He was so taken by it that this is his impression of what he heard. Now, what that meant, what that also means, is he then got in touch with Schoenberg, asked Schoenberg to be a part of what was then at that point in 1911, 1912 called the Blue Rider, which is a group that Kandinsky was instrumental in setting up, along with August Macke, Franz Marc, Gabriele Munter, others, and Schoenberg. And they put on an exhibition. They did a catalog called the Blaue Rider Almanac. They created another splinter group within ever more splintering groups within Munich society. And one needs to realize that wherever Kandinsky was, be it in Munich, be it in Russia, be it back in Berlin, in the Bauhaus, or in France, he connected himself with everybody. He got to meet them. He went to see them. He asked them to join his group, or he set up a group. He is extremely well connected. In every group that he gets involved with, he automatically becomes the president because he was so self-assured, so certain of what he was doing, so confident of his abilities that he automatically became president. So I'm talking now, it doesn't matter if it's in Munich with these splinter groups, in Russia where he becomes a lecturer at the university, he becomes head of this arts group and that arts council and that whatever, or to the Bauhaus and then on to France, he connects himself with everybody that's anybody. So when I said that after his apartment building was expropriated, he basically didn't need to worry. He was well connected. He had shows. He had dealers. He was set. So he becomes a very successful artist. Not to say that he isn't controversial, but that he is successful. And as some wag once said, nothing succeeds like a little scandal. Because certainly, if you think of the world of artists, be it today or back in Kandinsky's time, how do you get noticed? How do you set yourself apart from everybody else? It's not enough. It's not enough just to paint differently. It is not true, in my opinion, if you build it, they will come. I don't believe that. What I do believe is if you build it and market it well enough, they will come. And Kandinsky, not only by writing, but by joining groups and by leading discussions and just doing whatever he could to get himself and his group out in the public arena, marketed himself, marketed his groups, made statements about things that got quoted in newspapers or written about in journals. He made sure people knew who he was. Now, if this is Franz von Defregger, who was in, again, I'm going back now to backgrounds, what happened, what was happening. This Franz von Defregger, called The Hunter's Goodbye of the 1870s, is sort of what Munich, academic Munich art looked like. And you can see this early 1909 Kandinsky of the flowers in Murnau. By the way, Murnau is where Gabriele Munter had a house, and Kandinsky and she would often go to Murnau to work, to relax, to get out of Munich. But what the point here is that you have a vast differentiation between this narrative, realistic, perfectly chosen colors for the scene, three-dimensional background, all of the things that for us typifies sort of what good art should be. So you can imagine that if you're now in the 1880s, 1890s, even 1900s, you walk into an exhibition, you see something like that. Well, it's going to, first of all, take your breath away. You're going to say, is this really art? What is this? This is disgusting. But, you know, what's also going to happen? You're going to remember who that is. Because unfortunately, sometimes negative impressions stay longer in your mind than positive ones. So you're going to remember this guy. I mean, you know, just to give you a quick example, how many of us ever heard of Robert Mapplethorpe before the big controversy here? And we all know who he is, even if we don't like what he did. We all know who he is. So in any case, so what's happening here? What's happening is a whole tidal wave of change from an earlier world to a whole new one. We're moving from a world in which people had an absolute sense of what real material objects and reality was and how to represent it, to people who are creating with strange colors and shapes that sort of move and twirl all over the surface, don't even seem to have any sense of narrative context, of representational color, or of a sense of depth and three-dimensional space. And I mean, there's a whole sort of sea change that's happening here. And of course, it's all familiar to us now when you think of Charles Darwin or Sigmund Freud or any of the great thinkers of the late 19th, early 20th century. There's a huge, huge shift of what people call a paradigm from sort of a realistic, materialistic one to one that is more subjective. It's personal. It's highly individualized. It is discontinuous. So the people who want a sense of order and logic and rationality in life are over here. The people who like the idea of relativity, of individual choices, of perplexities, of nuances, of free floating concepts and art and life changing all the time, are going to be more sympathetic to this. But you can see, even if you sort of vacillate between one or the other, or belong to one or the other, you can understand that there's a great deal of change that is happening. There's a great deal of energy and synergy. But what makes it so dramatic is that for us, looking back, it just seems inevitable that this would become sort of the paradigm of modern art. But back then, that wasn't clear at all. Nobody knew at that point that these guys were going to be the winners. And again, another wag once said, art history is written about the winners, not the losers. So we're all grateful that art moved in this direction. Now, Kandinsky wrote a lot. I mean, if I can be snide, he was a lawyer, after all, by training, and he wrote, and he wrote, and he wrote. He wrote at least two books, one concerning the spiritual and art in 1911, and another Point and Line to Plane of 1926. But before that, or even in those, he saw the artist, as I wrote there, as a prophet, as a seer into that world that you cannot see, but is there nevertheless. And he based it not just on the synesthetic sense, but if we go back and think about Wagner and of Schoenberg and even Scriabin, who was also moving in that direction, he very much believed that there is a correlation between music and art. I mean, now specifically painting. Not just the synesthetic sense, but the fact that music, when you hear it, evokes in your mind thoughts, ideas, associations that come unbidden out of a musical form that's totally non-written. It's not even there. It's just a bunch of sounds. But it evokes in you a response. And that is not only for Kandinsky, but for a lot of people, the key to create the kind of art they do. Because they say, well, you may not be able to understand it, but it works like music. It's ethereal, it's ephemeral, but the colors and the lines and the shapes sort of evoke in your mind concepts and ideas, and therefore you can begin to understand what my art is all about. And Kandinsky was very explicit about this, and I'm going to read you a quote. He said, and this is from his book concerning the spiritual and art, color is the key. The eye is the hammer. The soul is the piano with its many chords. The artist is the hand that by touching this or that key sets the soul vibrating automatically. So he's very much aware that whatever color and line he puts on the surface, it's going to, like music, evoke chords and responses in your mind. And that is also why a lot, or indeed much, as you see here, if you can read my tiny scroll here, much of his works are called improvisations or compositions. They take a musical term to make their point. Now, he also is influenced by people like Madame Blavatsky and others that are into theosophy and into these ideas of sort of a unifying theory of the whole world that takes into account, you know, everybody from Islam to Christian to Judaism to naive traditions, all of those things that sort of create this idea that there's a total world harmony below the surface. And it works perfectly, even if today we consider it, quote, a pseudoscience. Back then, it was considered very relevant and very much of the moment. And the theories for people who believe there was a spiritual side to life that could be represented, the idea that there is a unity below the surface that we cannot see but which exists in these sort of religious and spiritual terms, is very compelling to people like Kandinsky and to others. So as I'm beginning to flush this out, you can see that there's a whole bunch of ideas, be they strictly logical to sort of semi-logical to very spiritual, that are percolating throughout this whole time. Now, I need to add one more concept here, and that is that something that we probably don't think much about, and that is the discovery of the electron. Now, I know diddly about physics and electrical engineering and stuff, but what I do know is that the electron was discovered in the late 1890s. It's a smaller particle of an atom. And Kandinsky, when this became clear, what it basically means is that matter, Newtonian matter, is no longer solid mass. It is made up of even smaller particles within it. And Kandinsky's response was, and again, like I said, he's a lawyer. He writes it all down. The collapse of the atom was equated in my soul with the collapse of the whole world. Suddenly, the stoutest walls crumbled. Everything became uncertain, precarious, and insubstantial. So here he has, in the scientific world, a perfect entree into the idea that there's larger realities that are more important to him below the surface than what exists on the surface, and that everywhere he looks, these ideas are percolating up to the surface. But the point, again, besides all of these things percolating into his mind and into his convictions that he is on the right path, is, of course, his ability to market it, to write it, to see himself not only as involved with the spiritual, not only the artist as prophet, but to put it in writing, to make it clear. If you read those books, they've been published in English, if you'd like to read them in translation, they tell you, they lay out for you what Kandinsky is thinking. Now, and as I said, there's more. There is his reminiscences, which he publishes in 1913. There are writings and journals and books. There are letters. There's a huge cache of information about Kandinsky. So unlike a lot of artists where you might challenge me and say, well, how do you know that? Who said that? Did you say that or did the artist say that? I can, in many cases, find you chapter and verse, maybe not tonight, exactly how Kandinsky phrased it and exactly how he said it, because he was so convinced that he had to get the word out. He had to market his ideas and his art. Now, I'm going to show you a couple of sort of artistic backgrounds. This is Franz von Stuck, a piece called Sin. This is his teacher. Stuck, as you can see, is sort of, I don't know, well, maybe you can't see, there's a very sort of erotic woman and there's a snake right there. Stuck is what we would now call a symbolist artist, who creates evocative scenes that are symbolic of larger realities. In this case, giving a human face and a seductive charm to the idea of sin. On the other screen is this design, which you see here by a man named August Endall, who created this. The facade was created in the 1890s, but destroyed during the war in 1944. And I show this to you because one of the other backgrounds is not just sort of the symbolist, the idea of this sort of larger ideas displayed now more representationally, but the idea of what's called Jugendstil, or Art Nouveau, the idea of using plant and ephemeral natural shapes and forms in this sort of evocative swirling shape to create an art form that was very, very popular in Munich and very much on the cutting edge around 1890-1900. Needless to say, I mean, as I said, Franz von Stuck was a student, Kandinsky was a student of Stuck, and he was a good friend of August Endall. Now, the reason I show you that is not just to show you the idea that this swirling form can in itself create evocative feelings and associations, but also to quote to you from Endall himself, who once said, "There is no greater error than the belief that the painstaking imitation of nature is art." And another man who I'm not going to show you, who was a sculptor in the Art Nouveau movement, again a friend of Kandinsky's, Hermann Obrist, said, "Pure form, art is my goal, away with every association." So they're already here, they're getting away from associational references. They're moving towards pure art, pure form, pure abstraction. And Kandinsky is just right in the middle of all of that. Henri Matisse, Pablo Picasso. I have to give a little plug to the National Gallery here. The point is, as I mentioned in passing in his bio, Kandinsky is in Munich, in Paris, 1905, 1906, exactly when the Fauvists, like this, are creating their work. And Kandinsky is deeply impressed by Matisse, particularly the Fauvist period, this sort of taking of unnatural color, dabbing it on, smearing it on in these strange perspectives and locations and concepts of how art and color all come together, which looks more sort of improvised than painted, more sort of just sort of thrown together with different colors playing off against one another. When you see that it's not sharp and precise and that the colors are unnatural and that the perspective is skewed, you can understand why the critics call them the fauves or the wild beasts. It's often the case that a negative term, a pejorative term, sticks. And in this case, we know them as the fauves, which was not a term of great support for them, but the bestial quality is what so shocked the people, but which Kandinsky was very taken by. Now, Pablo Picasso. You may well think Picasso has got to have a great influence on Kandinsky. Well, you'd be wrong. Either because he understood Picasso, or more likely because he didn't understand Picasso, Kandinsky thought this was just a fad, a transitional period. It was nothing of great substance, of great importance. So it is Matisse who influences him, not Picasso.
You're listening to a discussion of the life and work of Vasily Kandinsky with Dr. Christopher Wythe, Senior Lecturer at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C.
When Kandinsky goes back to Russia after the start of the First World War, he encounters what the Russian avant-garde is doing. The work of Kazimir Malevich, the work of L. Lissitzky, all of these people he knows. He communicates with them. He sets up art schools and gets involved with all kinds of art debates in Moscow. He's hired by the communist government to run art schools and to be head of the academies and everything else. So he's intimately connected with all these people. And this is the kind of art that the Russians are doing. Suprematist art in the case of Malevich, or constructivist art in the case of L. Lissitzky. And it looks perfectly suited to Kandinsky. It looks perfect, like the kind of thing that he wants to do. But you'd be wrong, for the same reason that you'd be wrong with Picasso. Because for Kandinsky, you have to realize that the artist was a prophet, a spiritual seer. These people, in Kandinsky's mind, were mentalists, thinking intellectually, including Picasso, intellectually arranging structures on a surface, but without the deep, prophetic, spiritual commitment. These are people just looking at art as abstracted forms that you can move around and create a composition, a construction, but they lacked a soul, an inner spirituality. And so Kandinsky, as I suggested and told you, already by the end of 1921, gets out of Dodge, as it was, goes back to Berlin, or in that, first of all, to Weimar, then Dessau, then Berlin, back in Germany to be part of the Bauhaus. When he leaves that part of his life, he moves to France, and he becomes, again, well-connected, even though it's a meager, dangerous, difficult time. He becomes connected to all the artists, and he's having shows, and he's having all the things that he did wherever he went. And he becomes great friends with Jean Arp, or Hans Arp, depending on how you want to call him, and Juan Miró. This is surrealism. And he professes not to be impressed by surrealism, but I want to show you in a little bit that there's more surrealism in Kandinsky than he will admit. And he begins to take on these sort of zoomorphic, biomorphic, sort of naturalistic, evolving shapes that lack hard edges and crisp lines the way Picasso and Malevich and Lissitzky were doing, create these sort of soft shapes that, as I said, have sort of entomological, zoological, biological references to a natural world that's sort of changing and becoming, but never really existing in its totality. And he loves this sort of indeterminate quality of these works, and he adapts it to himself as well. Now, what I want to do here towards the end is look at a series that he called, as you see on the screen, The Compositions. These, unlike he did Impressions, Improvisations, and Compositions. The Compositions, as you see from what I put up on the screen here, are his largest works. Now, by that I mean some of them are like 6 feet by 10 feet. They're huge. They're probably as big as this screen. They're immense. He did 10 of them from his early years in Munich till the late 30s. Now, as you see from what I wrote up here, not only did he do a lot of them, he did 10 of them. They are considered to be major pieces because they are large and they necessitated more conscious, deliberate, and protracted preparation than what he had done before. And by that, I mean that if you get into the compositions and look at them, what you will find is that for a lot of his improvisations and impressions, Kandinsky may well have done a couple of drawings and sketches. But for these, he did 30, 40, 50 of them. Not only drawings, but watercolor renderings and small color sketches to work the whole idea out. Because he knew, as I'm saying, these are his signature pieces. Now, as you see at the bottom here, it says, all of the arts, abstract painting is the most difficult. It demands that you know how to draw well. Now, that may come as a surprise, because a lot of us may think, oh, these guys just slap paint on the canvas. They didn't know how to paint at all. Well, in Kandinsky's case, you have to draw well. You have to have a heightened sensitivity to composition and colors, and you be a true poet. This last is essential, that you be a true poet. And that's what I mean why Leszczynski and Malevich and Picasso never appealed to Kandinsky, because they were not true poets. Now, there is another concept that gets involved in this, and Kandinsky refers to it all the time, and he calls it inner necessity. And I'll read you a quote. All methods are sacred if they are internally necessary. All methods are sins if they are not justified by internal necessity. I'm going to read you another quote. The artwork is born from inner necessity of the artist in a mysterious, enigmatic, and mystic way, and then it acquires an autonomous life. It becomes an independent subject animated by a spiritual breath. So once the artist creates it, it becomes a stand-in for the artist as prophet, the artist as seer. The artist is creating mystically, enigmatically, perhaps not entirely consciously, these great works of art. Now, what does that all mean? Well, let's look at the compositions, because they span his entire career. Now, I did write it up here that the first three were destroyed during the Second World War, so they no longer exist. So what I'm going to show you are the seven that survive. And here are the first two, of course, because it's four and five. Now, interestingly enough, seven of them, counting the first three that were destroyed, seven of them were created while he was in Munich. One is created in his Bauhaus years, two are created in his years in Paris. So they sort of scan his entire career, and we'll see how his art evolves and changes. Now, as you can see, they're composition 4, composition 5, 6, 7, et cetera. He's not going to tell you, oh, this is my take on X or Y. Color is the key. Kandinsky is hitting the keys, and it's reverberating into your soul. Now, the first big dramatic change that you have to understand is that right now, but this will change, but right now color is important to Kandinsky. Because he like a lot of artists, is beginning to realize, say, from Matisse on, who work in dramatic, evocative colors, that colors speak to us, at least in the Occidental world. You know, black, death, sadness, red might be anger, et cetera, et cetera. So that what Kandinsky has come to realize is that if you just put colors on the surface, you don't say blue in the sky, you just put blue somewhere, and what do we think of? We think of the spiritual, of the heavenly. So if he just puts green here, or red there, or yellow there, or mixes the colors, he's going to create evocative moods. Now, what it's debated, because there are lots of people who are all working madly towards abstract art or non-representational art, all 1910, 1911, and a lot of people say, well, this obscure artist in Scandinavia got there first, or this, well, the one who really got there first, who really made it, was Kandinsky, not Picasso. Picasso created abstracted art, but not non-objective, because for Picasso and Braque, they could not envision how you would understand their intellectual creations if you didn't see the subject. If you didn't know there was a nude woman, in the case of the gallery's picture I showed you, or a landscape, or a portrait, if you couldn't at least figure it out somehow, you wouldn't have understood the complexities of what Picasso and Braque were doing with their cubist work. And because it was so highly intellectual, as I said, Kandinsky would have none of it. But Picasso said, I cannot create a work without a subject, because for him, all it would be at that point is a decorative tapestry. But Kandinsky says, oh, Monsieur Picasso, you are wrong. Color itself speaks to you. Color without a narrative function will speak to you. And the same is true for forms. If you take a form, a line, a dot, a curve, and just put it on the surface by itself, it will speak to you. This is Kandinsky's idea. So that what you have here are these complex swirls of color and occasional line, but more color, that move and dance across the surface to create these incredibly beautiful and very evocative kinds of scenery. Now, the other element that gets, or two elements that get mixed into this, one is that, keep hitting the wrong button, I'm sorry. One of them is that all of these things have swirling colors and everything moving all over the surface as if they were created improvisationally, as if they were done on the spur of the moment. But Kandinsky knows that if color communicates, and as I gave you that quote, you must know how to draw, you must have a sense of composition and color and be a true poet. You cannot just put color on the surface and splatter it all over the place. It won't communicate. And particularly for Kandinsky, who believed that specific colors or specific mixtures of colors resonated in a very specific way. Again, he says these in his books. Then you have to choose your colors very, very carefully so that they say exactly what you want them to say. And so, as I said, not only are these canvases immense, but they are so well thought out. There are, as I said, 30, 40, whatever, sketches and studies and drawings that he does for these works, even before he does the actual painting. Now, in the years before World War I, Kandinsky is very, very much of the opinion that what will turn out to be World War I is actually an apocalyptical change of the world from a materialistic world to a spiritual world. I mean, obviously you can say, boy, did he get that wrong. But the reason I mention this is that all of these compositions have themes in them of deluge, of the rising of the dead, of apocalyptical events that for Kandinsky are, his prophetic announcement of a dawning spiritual age. And some of that may come across, even if you don't look more carefully, as we will in just a second, in the sort of hurried swirls of color and lines all over the surface, like somebody with an intensity of vision has to get it all out. There's a sense of the chaos and the sort of apocalyptical events that are happening almost reflected in the way the colors and the shapes and the lines move across the surface. It's almost as if it's already suggesting deluge and apocalypse and all of this. But he doesn't come out and say that. He just says, oh, this is composition 1, 2, etc. Now, the other thing that happens with Kandinsky is because we are still in the learning stage. We're still little babies with trainer wheels trying to understand the spiritual world. So what Kandinsky does is he gives us little clues here and there, schematized, pared down to the barest essential, which he says, see, if you look carefully, you might, oh, look, there's something there. What's that? There's something else there. For example, if you look at this painting, and of course this is what art historians dream of, to decipher all of the little symbols and meanings in something like Kandinsky or other artists. And so there is equally, art historically speaking, a whole plethora of literature about what Kandinsky is saying and what the forms, the colors all suggest. Because these are the little clues that, you know, because we're still babies and haven't been able to understand the spiritual world in and of itself, he gives us clues as to how to understand it. So that, for example, you see these black lines, there's like three little red dots. Well, these are said to be Cossacks with spears standing right here in the front. And over here, there are up in, well, even if you don't, you know, sort of like what, a mountain shape, a rainbow shape, but there are also up here a couple of very abstracted figures with these same sort of squiggly lines. There's sort of a castle up here on this blue hill. There seems to be a lot of frenetic activity. These are thought to be warriors fighting one another. Don't shoot the messenger. This is just what people are saying. But if you divide the work in half, again, this is the midpoint. Even if you don't sort of persuade it by what I'm starting to say, what you do see is that this side seems far more active and chaotic, and this is far calmer. I mean, that sort of, I hope, comes across. But what this side is, you have a pair of figures right here, see the heads and the bodies here, and another pair or landscape figures back here. This is calm. This is disordered chaos. In other words, this is the fight that is coming. This is the result. Chaos to spiritual calm and peacefulness. Now, I'm going to test your patience a couple more times to figure out what's going on here. This one, again, these are all done before he leaves Munich. This one has a sort of strong black swirly line here. Well, again, art historians, etc., say that there is an angel here blowing a horn, and this is the horn's sound coming out. Now, for Kandinsky, as I began to suggest before we looked at these, colors mean something. And black for him is a color of death, the color of a stasis, of nothing happening. So black is for him a color of death and eternity. So this black is very appropriate as the call of the angels, because even though, I mean, up and through here, again, you may or may not, if you look at this area as the angel here and the horn sort of here, there are other little angels and wings up here. What's happening down here? See the figures here, 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 and here? This is the rising of the dead in the second judgment. That's what that painting is all about. And again, his choice of colors, his choice of way he arranges, the sort of dramatic quality, all of these things are chosen carefully out of inner necessity to make the point of what he's trying to tell us. The same is true of these, like even more hectic, even more dramatic. This one is, or even this one, I mean, things seem to be exploding and flying all over the place. And these both deal, and I can make the point a little bit clearer. You see this shape? This is a boat with oars right here. And you can see waves right here, sort of moving across. Well, this is the deluge. Again, all apocalyptical, end-of-life series of events from the Bible, from Judaism, from anybody can take it from. All of these are common stories, folk tales, whatever. And think of these of large paintings. And if you filled them in this room, it would be like Kandinsky said back in the 1880s, like walking into one of those houses in Siberia and moving inside a painting where the whole thing is engulfs you and pulls you in. Now, the bottom one here is the most abstract of all of these, and it's sort of an exploding world. Everything sort of right here just sort of flying out from left to right and all over the place. This, again, is now becoming more complex to decipher because it is so highly abstracted. There is, or there was, for many, many years, a watercolor sketch that Kandinsky did for this composition that for the longest time was thought to be the first abstract watercolor done back in 1910. And it was only in the 1980s that an art historian realized that it wasn't the first independent abstract image. It was a study for this piece. So again, it's sort of kicking the can around as to who came up with the first abstract piece. Now again, there may be others who did it before Kandinsky, but it doesn't matter because Kandinsky is the giant among them. And I'll explain that at the end. So this is the most difficult to read, but it again is the explosion and the destruction of the world, the things flying off in different directions, cataclysmic events happening, colors and forms just blasting out from this inner core all to the sides of the composition. Now, if you keep these in mind, what happened here? This is Kandinsky. This one, this is the one he does in the years at the Bauhaus. This one, as you can see from the date, is from France. So this is his work in the 20s. This is Kandinsky doing compositions in the 30s. Now, clearly, what you see happening if you look at this one is a change in his whole psyche, his whole philosophy, because they're not dramatic and exploding and apocalyptic. It seems far more structured and organized and rational. This is, in part, the influence of the suprematist constructivist people like Malevich and Lisitsky that I showed you before. He does absorb what they're doing. He does understand what they're doing, and he tries to take it in. But as I said to you, it has to come. That is, any image has to come from inner necessity. So for Kandinsky, the ideas of what Malevich and Lisitsky and others are doing in Russia is interesting technically, but it's not great art because it lacks the inner spiritual necessity. So Kandinsky, throughout his life, is the great German romantic. Because if art doesn't have a soul, if it's just idea, it's not getting to the point. So in other words, for Kandinsky, even though the world has changed, he is still out to make the spiritual accessible. He still believes in the spiritual world. And that, again, is separating him from all these other artists. Now, I want to read you a quote. In September of 1914, before he left for Russia, he wrote to his friend Paul Klee, who, by the way, will be a colleague, a professor, fellow professor of his at the Bauhaus. He writes to Klee, "What happiness there will be when this horrible time is over. What will come afterwards? A great explosion, I believe, of the purest forces which will carry us on to brotherhood. And likewise, an equally great flowering of art, which must now remain hidden in dark corners." So he's very much believing, as I said to you, that this apocalyptical event is what World War I was actually going to be. But when it doesn't materialize, it doesn't mean, even though his art changes, as it should. Because you don't want, as an artist, to get stuck in the same old rut. You've got to move with the times. You've got to change. Otherwise, you will become retardataire. Now, what Kandinsky does is take on, as I'm suggesting to you, the ideas of his Russian and Bauhaus German colleagues and becomes to structure his work. Now remember, Kandinsky, among other things, taught students the formal courses of how to use colors, lines, and shapes on a composition. So he was very much into the educator at this point. He had a mission to convert all the students that came to the Bauhaus to the new ideas. And so again, it's a perfect vehicle for him to communicate his ideas, now not so much as spiritual propagandist, but as artist educator. And all of these things now, what is happening is the colors, as you can see, become far more regularized and systematized. But what becomes more important now is not color, but form. The forms that he uses. Because like the colors that have specific associations, so too do forms. A straight line suggests horizontal, the world. A line going up suggests rising to the spiritual. Angular lines may suggest pain and suffering or anguish. Squiggly lines may suggest joy and quixotic feelings. But what if those lines and those if those lines are then infused with a yellow color or a red color or a green? Because for him, the color combinations run basically, the first duality is between yellow and blue. And if you mix them, you get green, which sort of sits in the middle. Yellow, like the Schoenberg image, where you have that burst of yellow, is energy, is passion, is the loud blast of a trumpet, according to Kandinsky. Whereas blue, as you would expect, is quieter, is spiritual, it recedes. Yellow jumps forward, blue retreats. If you mix them, you get green, which for Kandinsky sort of lies between the two, and actually, in his mind, is the color of the bourgeoisie, complacent, static, unmoving, unchanging. If you move then to black versus white, black, as I said, is the color of death, of eternal silence. White is the color of all possibilities. And then he goes on from there to discuss other colors and combinations, and he does the same with various shapes, triangles, points, circles. For him, a circle, basically, is the idea of like white is, the sign of all possibilities, all contained within the circle. You know, which is why, you know, at diplomatic events, everybody sits in a circle, so nobody's at the head of the table. Everybody's equal. So what if you put a black in the circle? What if you took a triangle and put yellow in it? What if you took a square and put green in it? All of these things will change the way, in his mind, you respond to the image. So even though this has now become far more regularized and systematized, those and the forms more pronounced than they were before, he is still seeing all of this as this complex interplay between shapes and forms. And then, of course, it all moves across a surface that has no sense of back and front. As I said in 1920, or I didn't say, but I showed you this on the screen, he wrote a book called Color and Line to Plane in 1926. And that's what he's talking about. The plane is the canvas. It's like an organism that just sort of, like a petri dish, and you drop things in and it swirls and it changes and it becomes something magical. That's what's happening here. He takes it, as you see down at the bottom, in 1936, he takes it a step further. Now he, as I said, is in Paris, and I mentioned before the influence of Miró and Arp. And that is what begins, and surrealism is what's beginning to come out here. It is a further distillation of what he's done here and what he did before. Again, here, the idea of the circle as the infinite possibilities and how the colors in the circle with yellows or blacks or reds or whatever around them, how all of that reverberates in your eye. Now, some of us, if you've been to see the Joseph Albers show, might see a lot of that in the way he places colors next to one another. For Albers, colors didn't mean a fig. They didn't mean a thing. All they were good for was for visual perception and subjective interplay of shapes and forms. Some look big with a certain color next to them. Some look small, if you think of all of his squares. He didn't see any intellectual abilities in them. For Kandinsky, all of this, is spiritual. All of it. And no matter what, you know, how you react to it, the point for him is that the color draws you in, sort of the way it did for that Monet, where he just saw the colors and shapes and it drew him in. The same thing happens here. I'm getting drunk with my own philosophies here. What you're seeing here is Kandinsky doing the same thing, drawing you in with the colors and the shapes. Oh, that's so wonderful. I wonder what that is. And you draw closer, and you try and make sense of it. You try and understand it. And that's where Kandinsky sort of gets the hook. You first get that sense of pleasant color and composition. It draws you to it, and then you begin to try and make sense of it, because we all want to make sense out of what we're looking at. What does that mean? What is it? Now, the other thing is the very last one, done in 1939. He dies in 1944, is this one. And as I wrote at the bottom, the more frightening the world becomes, the more art becomes abstract. And that's an interesting thing to think about, particularly since it was written not by Kandinsky originally, but by a man named Wilhelm Voringer, who in the early 20th century wrote a book called Abstraction and Empathy, where he talks about empathy is when we are in tune with the world, so we work naturalistically. When we're not in tune with the world, then we become abstract. We're disengaged. We don't understand it. We have to try and figure it out. And that's where Kandinsky is going with things like this. Now, it's interesting, again, this, as I said, now in Paris, and sort of surrealist, Miro, and ARP sort of shapes, because he's not only looking at what they're doing, but he's looking at books on zoology, entomology, biology, looking at all the sort of shapes like amoebas and swirling little forms. You know, I'm not a scientist, so don't ask me what all that means. But, you know, he's looking, because they're sort of like, they're building blocks. Whew, my God. They're building blocks of the world. These amoeba-like biomorphic or zoological shapes that ARP and Miro are dealing with as surreal sort of senses of an emerging, burgeoning, changing world that hasn't yet taken form. That's where Kandinsky is going with all of these things as well. Now, he was deprived in the sense that obviously in the Second World War, living on the outsides of Paris, it was a tough time, so he didn't necessarily always get materials or get the things he wanted. But he never gave up his basic idea of speaking and making his point, no matter in what shape. And it's sort of, to me, interesting that at the very end of his, or close to the end of his life, of course, he didn't know that in 39, but that the last of the compositions, and again, these are huge, even bigger than this image, what he's chosen is to put it on a black background. Because black is the color of death, the sense of the end of life, the stillness of eternity. And out of this eternity, out of this black stillness, and the others never, never have a black background. They have different colors, and maybe the white of the canvas shows through, but he never, never coats the whole background black the way he does it here. And yet, out of that black death and eternal silence springs all this sort of like confetti, sort of Mardi Gras, joy and happiness and possibility. And I think in a large sense, this is exactly the way he's feeling. Yes, times are tough and it's difficult, but there's so many wonderful things still going on in the world. And I want to communicate that by showing you this sort of joyous, sort of party-like swirl of colors and shapes against the sense of death and despair. Now, the very end, I want to show you these two works. Again, I write at the bottom, all methods are sacred if they are internally necessary. All methods are sins if they are not justified by internal necessity. The quote I read to you before. And you can see, again, giving the National Gallery a plug, here is the gallery's improvisation called Improvisation 31 and subtitled, not by the artist, Sea Battle. And here is this almost at the end of his life, 1941. And you can see how he has traveled in terms of here, as I said, colors and forms swirling all over the place to a far more ordered, sort of zoomorphic, biological, sort of structured, formal relationship where colors are important here. And so in conclusion, the last thing I wanted to say is that, as I sort of indicated throughout my talk, that Kandinsky becomes the major focus of abstraction into the modern world. This does not mean that other artists didn't work parallel to him, or maybe even create abstract art even earlier. It's just that they didn't get the word out. They didn't publicized. They weren't central to the art activity of every place they went. And in writing about it and thinking about it, Kandinsky set up the basic premises, the basic concepts for what abstraction should be. And it's not an abstraction that is of the head. It is an abstraction of the inner necessity, of the spirit. So if you think of abstract expressionism, for example, that's a perfect follow-up to what Kandinsky has set up as the paradigm for what spiritual art should be. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to a discussion with Dr. Christopher Wythe, Senior Lecturer at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. This recording took place at the American Goethe Society in Washington, D.C. The recording engineer was Tomasz Marek.